2022, CFRC Power Plays has become the number one destination for all things Queens football.
And that is a touchdown for the Gales!
With over 50 million lifetime views, CFRC Power Plays is the defining voice in Queens football coverage.
Looking for Nico Cuomo! Cuomo! My goodness! Nico Cuomo with a touchdown!
Follow us today on Instagram at CFRC Power Plays, your number one spot for rock solid football action. When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell and our Summer Arts Coordinator Genevieve Hinch. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, providing an update on the future of the Homelessness and Addiction Recovery Treatment Hub.
At their last meeting, council once again tackled the uncertain future of Kingston's addiction services. It was announced in March that Consumption and Treatment Services, CTS, which has operated alongside the Integrated Care Hub since 2018, would close effective September 30th, 2026. The CTS serves hundreds of vulnerable residents annually, preventing overdose deaths and averting emergency room visits. This closure is due to the provincial decision to cut funding to CTS sites across Ontario, effective June 13th. After much uncertainty about what would come next, the province announced on April 10th that a new Homelessness and Addiction Recovery Treatment Hub, or HART Hub, will be established in Kingston. Provincial HART Hubs will provide services related to addiction recovery, primary care, and supportive housing. However, unlike the CTS model, HART Hubs require abstinence as a condition of access and will not provide services like drug checking, needle exchange, and safe consumption. Counselors and local experts alike have acknowledged there will be significant gaps upon the closure of CTS. In a lengthy meeting in March, council began discussing what the CTS closure means and how the city will navigate it. At their meeting on Tuesday, May 5th, now with the knowledge of a confirmed HART Hub from the province, council continued the conversation. A motion from the Arts, Recreation, and Community Policies Committee came before council, laying out a multi-part response to the looming closure of Kingston's CTS site. Two pieces focus on understanding the impact. Council asks the city's chief administrative officer to report back on what the provincial decision will mean for the Integrated Care Hub. Everything from the building lease to programming. Staff are also being directed to work with Kingston Community Health Centers to collect detailed data on harm reduction services to paint a clearer picture of what's being lost. There's also a communications component aimed at making sure residents know where to turn. The city will work with local partners to share information about available supports once the CTS site closes. The most notable parts of the motion are two more action-focused items. First, council is directing the city solicitor, alongside the mayor and chief administrative officer, to formally assess whether the situation warrants a municipal declaration of emergency. That assessment is expected back in the third quarter of 2026. Second, council is committing $350,000 in new funding to support community-driven solutions. The money will go toward pilot projects proposed by local organizations, with a focus on new harm reduction initiatives that can potentially operate at a lower cost. Councillor Brandon Tozzo added one more item to the list with an amendment: that council formally opposed the provincial government's decision to close CTS.
I think that there's a substantial amount of work on the financial side has been done, but I think it's important that we send a clear message to the community where we as a political body stand on this. this is, closing of this will cause harm. It will affect a vulnerable community. And I want us to just make it a position that we fully oppose the closure of the CTS in the city of Kingston.
Councillors Gary Osteroff and Jimmy Hassan were opposed to the amendment. Osteroff was supportive of the new Heart Hub model as a replacement, and Hassan pointed to the provincial responsibility for healthcare matters.
I can't support this. I believe that the heart and with addiction recovery, I believe that it's the better way to go. So I can't support this.
I think it's not a good strategy to just oppose their decision. That was their decision. That's their department. That's their responsibility. So we have to live with it, but we'll continue to support whatever, however we can do. I will not support this amendment.
Mayor Brian Patterson, who seconded the amendment, spoke to the importance of CTS's place in the addiction care ecosystem in addition to a heart hub.
I think it was Councillor Ridge, who is not here tonight, who I think put it very eloquently when we first debated this, said what we really need is a CTS and a heart hub. This is not about suggesting that we're not in favor of the Heart Hub. The Heart Hub is great. It's a huge new investment into the community that will offer hope and recovery for those that are struggling with addiction. I'm a huge supporter of it, and I can hardly wait to see it up and running. What I'm suggesting, and I think that what has been discussed, is that ideally you would have both so that you can have a place where you can meet people where they're at. Obviously, not everybody is ready to immediately move into recovery. So allow them to be able to access harm reduction services and then be able to transition into the Heart Hub. I think you could see both of those working together. So this is really, in my view, I was happy to second this because I think it just shows on principle that if it was up to us, we would want both. It's not in any way poking at the province, where I think we've been very vocal that we've been helpful or very grateful for the Heart Hub. But I think it still is very clear that ideally you would have both. So for that reason, I'm happy to second this amendment.
The amendment passed with a vote of 8-2. Councillors Osteroff and Hassan opposed. When discussion returned to the full motion, Councillor Jeff McLaren spoke in support, especially noting the importance of the $350,000 in funding for new projects and the opportunity for change.
This came as a result of ideas that were coming from the public that could help support the city's harm reduction efforts at a lower cost. And since we are looking for ways to save money, it seems that this is an opportunity to see if that could happen. That's the whole point of this pilot project. Take ideas from people on the front lines that want to start new enterprises, social enterprises that actually benefit people in a new and different way. I think this is a great way forward, and I hope that it succeeds, because what we've been doing up until now seems to be the situation seems to be getting worse, regardless of what we continue to throw the money we throw at it. So it's time to find some new ideas, and hence the word new community groups and new proposals.
Councillor Connie Glenn also spoke in support of the motion, with hope for the future of services in Kingston, but still bracing for the impact of the CTS site closure.
I'm very heartened to see this motion coming forward, and I hope that it's going to pass. I think I feel a positive wind here. I do believe that pilot projects may lead to some gold nuggets. We have deep-seated challenges here, and removal of support for the CTS is eventually going to hit this community really hard. So I think one of the things that needs to be reiterated here is that removal of these sites in other municipalities has led to an increase in overdoses. It's led to increased emergency room visits. Hamilton's one of the places that's been mentioned a few times that's seen this sort of thing happen. So I'm glad that we're going to do what we can to bridge the gap and hopefully preserve some services and see where we go from there. But in the short term, I think this is the right step forward for us. And then we'll have to have more conversations about how we get those other gaps filled and how we get the province to fill them for us, because we can't continue this way as we've seen with our budgetary pressures.
In the end, the motion carried with a vote of 9-1. Councillor Gary Osteroff opposed. Addiction and Mental Health Services KFLNA will be the lead agency for the new Heart Hub services. For now, the city clarified in a release that Kingston Community Health Center's Street Health Center will continue to provide primary care, addiction treatment, and harm reduction services. Low-barrier services like the Access and Support Center, Rest Zone, and other integrated care hub programming will continue through and after the transition to a Heart Hub.
Hopefully, things will not deteriorate any further with the interventions that we're putting in place.
For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to Dinah Jansen with a story by Michelle Dory Forestell, LJI reporter for The Kingstonist, about Napanee Council's decision to switch from the Community Foundation grant to an in-house funding model.
Thank you, Jesse. Greater Napanee Council has finalized its move away from a long-standing partnership with the Lennox and Addington Community Foundation, opting instead to bring its community grant program fully in-house, while resolving lingering questions about what happens to roughly $30,000 already held by the foundation. At its meeting on Tuesday, April 28th, Napanee Council approved amendments to its community grants policy and endorsed a revised approach that will see those funds distributed locally through grants rather than returned to the town. The decision builds on a Tuesday, March 20th, 2026 council resolution that directed staff to exit the foundation agreement and request the return of approximately $29,800, money originally contributed as part of a municipal endowment. What council did not yet have clarity on when they voted in March was whether the funds could be legally returned at all. The resolution directed staff to retrieve the money, but subsequent review found it had been contributed as a charitable endowment, a structure that typically does not allow withdrawals once funds are committed. That left council with a choice: continue pursuing a complex and uncertain withdrawal process or find an alternative. Instead, they endorsed what CAO Matthew Grant described as an elegant solution. Under the revised approach, the town will still exit the foundation agreement and redirect future funding into its own community initiatives fund, but the existing $30,000 will be distributed by the foundation as local grants, likely in 2027. The change avoids the need for the town to manage the funds as a formal trust, which would involve ongoing investment oversight, reporting requirements, and administrative costs. The policy amendment also simplifies the way the town delivers grants more broadly by consolidating multiple funding streams into a single municipally controlled program. The shift reflects both practical and policy considerations, according to the town. In March, staff described the dual system with funding flowing through both the community foundation and the town as effectively a duplication of services. At the same time, demand for the town's own community initiatives fund has already outpaced available resources. During its first intake, the program received more than $100,000 in applications, but was able to distribute only $15,000. Redirecting the town's annual $10,000 contribution from the foundation was expected to increase available funding by roughly 25%. The two systems also operate under different rules. As a registered charity, the Community Foundation is limited to funding qualified recipients such as registered charities. The town's program, by contrast, can support a broader range of community initiatives, including grassroots and informal groups that would not otherwise qualify. That flexibility was a key factor in Council's decision to consolidate funding under municipal control. While the financial impact of the April 28th decision is relatively modest, it marks a broader shift in how Greater Napanee approaches community funding. With the policy changes now approved, the town will phase out its relationship with the Community Foundation, redirect future contributions into its own fund, and allow the remaining endowment to be distributed locally through grants over the coming years.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Coming up next, we have Genevieve Hinch reading a story by Keith Dempsey, LJI reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about a $5,000 Enbridge grant that will support youth programming at the Gananoque Public Library.
Thank you, Jesse. A $5,000 grant from Enbridge will support youth programming at the Gananoque Public Library, helping sustain a local drop-in initiative aimed at providing a safe and inclusive space for young people. The funding will go toward the Gananoque Youth Drop-In Program, which is led and delivered by the RNJ Youth Services in partnership with the library. Town officials say the program offers a welcoming environment where youth can connect, build skills, and get access to support in the community. Representatives from Enbridge and the RNJ Youth Services were in Gananoque on April 29th for a small ceremony recognizing the contribution and highlighting the impact of the program. The drop-in initiative is supported through a partnership that includes the Town of Gananoque, the Gananoque Library Board and staff, and the YMCA of Eastern Ontario. Officials say the investment will help strengthen programming for local youth while supporting efforts to create inclusive community spaces. The town noted the program plays an important role in fostering opportunities for young people and contributing to their overall well-being.
And thank you to Genevieve Hinch and Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Ted Evans, LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, with a story about the start of construction on a new pump track in Amherstview.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
Construction of the new pump track at Loyalist Park in Amherstview will begin on May 11th, with an expected completion date of July 30th. Thanks to a confidential donation of $500,000, the construction of the pump track will not impact the township's budget. It will be developed at no cost to Loyalist Township other than staff time to oversee it. The entire project, including the skate park, is estimated to cost approximately $1 million and is being completed in two phases. Phase 1 is the construction of the pump track, including a skate bowl, while Phase 2 will include the completion of the remaining skate park features, subject to securing additional funding. Council heard a presentation in June of 2025 from New Line Skate Parks, an engineering firm with expertise in skate park construction. Now with approval, the company is beginning construction. A public consultation process is currently taking place on the township's website. Vice President and Director of Business Development with New Line Skate Parks, Trevor Morgan, spoke about the benefits of the skate parks and pump tracks they build and the one they're looking to build in Loyalist Township.
Very integrated, green space, connections to pathways, color, texture, art installations. That can be very exciting to put a signature, I guess, of the community within the architecture of the park, even through different lighting schemes, if that's something that's desired. And then accessibility, you're likely to have folks from the adaptive community who would like to ride this park. So yeah, every park has its story, and we hope there's a story to be told here with the township.
Morgan noted the potential boost in tourism the facility could bring.
A network of these parks are being created in communities across Canada and across Ontario, and there's a large population that will want to experience each different unique park and communities, and they'll purposely travel around, stop in these communities, visit, spend money at local businesses, maybe even spend a night. I know when I was 12 years old on the family trip and I was an avid skateboarder, I could be very influential to spend an extra night in a community if they had that one skate park.
Morgan spoke about the potential of events at the facility as well.
You're likely to have user groups and community groups that will say, hey, we would love to have some level of organized events there that could be lessons nights, some community-based contests and so forth. And so we really try to design a modern park with that in mind.
Councillor Paul Proderick spoke about neighboring communities and their skate parks, as well as what a new one in Amherstview could do for the community.
I think the closest one to us is Napanee, and then you go to Picton's got a great site, but again, it's probably 20 years old now. I think it becomes a hub for gathering, and it fits into the master recreation plan. Also, an opportunity to add something to the community, and I think we haven't had a recreational facility addition in well over, I'm going to say, 40 years. And again, it's just through the leadership of a community member who wishes to help out in times where we don't have a lot of money to do a lot of things that we'd like to do.
Councillor Jake Ennis spoke about the donation and choice of the donor.
It's a very generous donation. We're really appreciative to the for the donation, and I think the donor's chosen well. It's a amenity that with an amenity that focuses on youth, and one that I think will be very well used.
Deputy Mayor Nathan Townend showed his appreciation towards the donor, as well as what the project will do for youth in the area.
It's incredibly generous and provides an amazing opportunity for us, and to appreciate the particular kinds of youth that something like this can engage, you know, based on the whole lifestyle and culture that goes with it. Not one I claim to understand. I think it's not just, you know, youth engagement writ large in some sort of big broad context. This is something quite specific that I think will cater to members in our community that otherwise don't have a facility like this.
Councillor Carol Parks noted the activity at Napanee's skate park.
I do go by the one in Napanee quite regularly, and it is a gathering place. You see all sorts of demographics and ages and different usage of it, so I fully support this.
Mayor Jim Hagedorn spoke about the progress in access to skateboarding facilities and shared a story from his youth.
I was in my teens on probably a $10 skateboard trying to go down the largest hill where I lived at the time, called Big Hill, and with blind corners. It's come a long way. When I was young, I've actually seen some of the, like, Madoc. They have a nice one there. I remember when they were building the first phase, and I was kind of like, what is going on in there? And now to see it now, it's been developed into the whole park is basically devoted to this now, and it's packed all the time. It is something that is what I believe will be well used, and this is a great opportunity, I think, for Loyalist Township to be able to provide another amenity new to the community that will be used, very well used, I believe, for an extended period of time.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to CFRC's own Jesse Bell with the CFRC Sports Report.
Thank you, Dinah. The Kingston Grenadiers Youth Football Club will kick off their 2026 season on May 16th in Ottawa. A not-for-profit, volunteer-run youth development program, the Kingston Grenadiers played their inaugural season in 2004 as part of a U18 AAA football organization known at the time as the Ontario Varsity Football League, since renamed to the Ontario Summer Football League. After five seasons of strictly U18 play, the club expanded to offer a U16 program in 2009. After a temporary stint as the Kingston Junior Gales in 2022, the team went back to the Grenadier branding in 2023 and also began to expand its services, fielding U14 and U12 teams. Over 200 players will suit up for the Grenadiers in 2026 across their four age cohorts, and of those 200, roughly 10% will be coming from low-income backgrounds. The coaching staff is composed of volunteers, many recruited from the high school coaching ranks in the area. While the club struggled to find success in the 2010s, the program has turned a corner in recent years, consistently fielding championship-caliber teams in multiple age brackets. Expectations are particularly high for the 2026 U18 squad after a 7-0 regular season in 2025. Six players from the U18 Grenadiers were selected to play in the Football Ontario Red Black Weekend, including defensive end Adrian Stangetta, running back Declan Cowan, and H-back Tom Alliver. The 2026 home opener will be played on May 23rd at Richardson Stadium, starting with the U12 team at 11 a.m. and concluding with the U18 team at 6:30 p.m. Tickets can be purchased from the Richardson Stadium box office on game day. In other Kingston sports news, Queens offensive lineman and the second overall pick in the CFL draft, Nicholas Hennig, has announced that he has signed a contract with the Las Vegas Raiders of the National Football League. Hennig is the sixth player in program history to make the jump to the NFL. He joins running back Jim Young, 1965, running back Hino Lillis, 1966, who was also a practice squad player for the Dallas Cowboys, offensive tackle Mike Shad, a 1986 first-round draft pick for the LA Rams, the only U Sports player ever selected in the first round, Brad Elberg, 1993, who played for the Philadelphia Eagles, and most recently, offensive tackle Matt O'Donnell, who in 2011 signed with the Cincinnati Bengals. It is unlikely that Henning will dress for the Raiders in 2026, but he is a shrewd developmental signing for a team that is talent-starved on the offensive line, who also recently drafted a new quarterback with the first overall pick in the 2026 NFL Draft. Whether it's Vegas or Toronto, there is no doubt that the Milton, Ontario product has a bright future ahead of him in professional football.
And thank you again to Jesse Bell for that update, and also thank you to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell with your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Tuesday, May 12th, 11 degrees is your high, but it's going to feel a lot warmer, close to 18 degrees in the bright sunshine. It is going to cool down quite a bit overnight, however, as we will have a daytime high of just 11 degrees on Wednesday, May 13th, with a 68% chance of precipitation. It will stay consistently cool going into the following Thursday, May 14th. 11 is your high, but with a 60% chance of precipitation, it's going to feel closer to 7 degrees. It is going to get nice for the weekend, though, folks. Friday, May 15th, daytime high of 14 degrees. Beautiful sunshine, making it feel closer to 17. Saturday, May 16th, daytime high of 16, feeling like 20 in the sunshine. That's more like it for the month of May. Sunday, May 17th, daytime high of 17 degrees, feeling 17 degrees in the sunshine. And then kicking off next week, we've got a run of warmer weather starting with Monday, May 18th, daytime high of 18 degrees, feeling like 20. Now, that is what I'm talking about.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present Somewhere Between Here and Brooklyn, the sound of Seth W.J. Hunt, Alone in a Room, One Mic, No Extras. Stripped to its bones, Seth's new EP captures every moment that would normally be polished away. Blending the quiet ache and storytelling of Wilco Brighteyes and Cameron Winter, Hunt's original songs feel both intimate and personal. The record also reimagines two iconic tracks, pulling Red Hot Chili Peppers' Other Side and Pearl Jam's Black into a stark acoustic space where the weight of the lyrics hits even harder. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Seth W.J. Hunt's Somewhere Between Here and Brooklyn on your favorite platforms and enjoy the lead single from it here called Stay with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Try that again.
I'll go back to your house if you want. Can you take me back? And I'll do anything you want me to do. And I'll sit back and relax. And I will stay until tomorrow. And then I'll take the train back home. It's not the home that I wanted. It's not the home that I need. But I'll stay. 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 But I'll stay.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host of this week's Grad Chat.
This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times.
A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. And today, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Chikiziram Woke, who is doing a Shirk postdoc, researching with Dr. Grace Adeneni Ogun-Yenkin. Welcome to Grad Chat.
Thank you so much, KM. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I really appreciate your time, and I'm really excited to dive into the research that you're working on now. But before we start, because you are a postdoc, I'd like to know a little bit more about your earlier studies and kind of your academic journey up until this point. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, thank you for that question. I started my education in Nigeria, where I did my undergrad. I studied archaeology and tourism. Then after that, I moved to Germany. I kind of pivoted a bit. I studied international media culture at the University of Darmstadt. And then I moved to Canada, where I did my another master's degree in at Memorial University of Newfoundland. Studied anthropology. Then I moved to Carleton, that's in Ottawa, to do my PhD in anthropology with a focus on political economy before I moved to Queen's for my postdoc.
You've been wide-traveled through your academic career so far.
Sure. I also did a few fellowships. I did one at the University of Edinburgh, and I also did another one at Brown University in 2023. So yes, I've traveled quite a bit, and it's been awesome so far.
Well, we're very excited to have you here now at Queen's. And I was curious, folks may not know, but with Shirk postdoctoral fellowships, you need to identify a faculty supervisor and a university or location of tenure in your application. So I was curious to know, what attracted you to Queen's for your current research project?
Primarily, I was attracted to Queen's by Dr. Grace Adeneye Ogun-Yenkin, who is the Canada Research Chair in Youth and African Urban Futures, which is very related to the work I did for my PhD, but also in a sense related to the work I do now. I worked with her on the board of the Canadian African Studies Association when she was the president and I was the grad student representative. And the working relationship was really productive. And I also got to know about the great work she's doing around the subject of youth and urban futures. And yeah, I wanted to work more with her. So I applied for the Shirk basically to work with her. And I'm glad I got it. And I'm glad I'm here working with her. And I've also always had my eye on Queens. Mm. I really wanted to do a PhD at Queens, but I mean, life took me to Carleton. Mm-hmm. But I'm glad I did not miss out being at Queens, right? So Queens is, you know, a top research university by all standards. So I've had, you know, I've crossed paths with a lot of the professors here and the grad students here at conferences. And I really wanted to have a taste of it. So, you know, Queens attracted me here, the prestige of Queens, but also Kingston. I've been to Kingston with my family a few times for the Christmas and for the holidays to attend some music festivals. Mm. And I really, really loved my experience here. So all these factors kind of intersected to bring me here.
Mm. Oh, well, we're so happy that you chose Queens and that you're here with us now. And I would say Kingston is such a pretty place, especially if you're visiting during December and the holidays and all the limestone buildings downtown. I know Ottawa has lots of historic buildings, but their downtown is continually under construction. So
that is true.
So now that you're here in Kingston, your current research project is titled Tech into the Future: Immigration, Black Youth Empowerment, and Digital Technology in Canada's Shifting Economy. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your project entails?
Sure, I'll be happy to. My research focuses on Black immigration, livelihoods, and emerging technologies in Canada. I'm interested in understanding how newcomers position themselves for success in the labor market, to know what kind of skills they acquire and why they acquire the skills, and generally how immigrants are situated in the global tech and IT ecosystem. So for a little bit of context, Canada has seen an increase in its Black population with a rise of over 125% in the past 20 years. Mm. And Canada's immigration regime is quite unique in that it prioritizes youths with tertiary level education and high expertise in a variety of fields like medicine, like tech, like education. Mm-hmm. And Black people are keen into this. We've seen a lot of immigration from Africa and the Caribbean over the past 10 to 15 years. Mm. And despite the fact that many of these young people come with high expertise, mm-hmm. they still face several issues in Canada. Mm. Many of them include, underemployment, especially for women who are not able to use their educational credentials that they acquired from their home countries here. So my project tries to understand how Black immigrants negotiate special mobility by relocating to Canada and class mobility by acquiring these in-demand tech skills. I also want to know exactly how they strategize to be able to break into these seemingly closed-off structures and ecosystems. And some of the questions guiding my research would be what factors influence economic opportunities and a sense of belonging among Black immigrant youth in Canada? What kind of gendered, global, and national specific issues that they face in, at the intersection of their race and ethnicity and sexuality? And also, what kind of networks they build and they depend on to be able to excel in the ecosystem.
Yeah, no, that's a great overview. Thank you. I know it sounds right now economy is the front of mind of many conversations as Canada and the world is experiencing some large shifts. But I think this is especially important to see what happens to Black youth who come to Canada, as you said, highly skilled, motivated with exactly what Canada's looking for, but there seems to be a disconnect when they arrive and how that's not maybe necessarily translating in the way that government policy thinks it'll happen, and also in the lived experiences of people hoping to bring those great skills they have to their new lives in Canada. And, you know, why is that? It sounds like your work is really investigating that.
Right.
Mm. So what are some of the patterns you're starting to see?
Yes, so I'm seeing that the tech sector has become a shared space where Black immigrants find community, mentorship, and also engage with different possibilities, right? Mm. So we're beginning to see the emergence of Black-focused organizations and institutions that's dedicated to teaching some of these skills to Black immigrants. Some of them are doctors, some of them are historians, but many believe that tech is the future, right? Mm. And that's also the way that I believe the government is framing it, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of money in the just released and passed budget is focused on AI and tech. So I would say there's a mix of hysteria and opportunity as well, mm-hmm. where people are like, oh my God, I have to pivot to tech to be able to survive and to be able to take care of my family and to be able to meet my dreams. Another thing we are seeing is the rise of mentorship networks as well.
Mm.
So many of these Black people come and they are hooked up onto mentorship networks. And some of these networks are like community driven. They're not funded by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Some are funded by different institutions,
mm-hmm.
Canada-based institutions, but funded by institutions based in their sending countries, right? In the countries that these immigrants come from.
Mm-hmm.
So many of them come to Canada, or even before they come, they are hooked onto these networks and they get trained and mentored to acquire relevant tech skills. And some of these mentorship networks are also women focused.
Mm.
Some of them are dedicated to teaching or training women, young women especially, on these in-demand tech skills, which is kind of good.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are also seeing the fact that some of these networks are also like domiciled on WhatsApp,
mm-hmm.
and on different tech platforms. But then there's also the precarity side, because of the way that the economy is shifting and is structured. We also see that a lot of Black people who come are only able to get gig-based, you know, work or contract work, and many of them are often laid off only a few months into their employment,
mm-hmm.
right? So we also see the precarity side of it, where many of these trainings that they receive are not able to translate into stable careers.
Mm.
And we also see many of them who get work also being discriminated against, facing mm-hmm. a lot of discriminations based on their race, on their ethnicity, on language, on faiths, on gender, and, you know, multiple intersectionalities.
Mm-hmm.
So these are some of the patterns I'm beginning to see. But the research is still on the way. We're in the process of acquiring ethics approval and going to do some ethnographic work, which I think touches on one of your questions.
Mm-hmm. No, this sounds, it's very multifaceted, right? Like the patterns you're seeing are coming and emerging from many different aspects of people's work lives, personal lives, like different facets of their identities. So with this really complicated story that you're seeing, how do you capture this? Like, what are some of the methods that you're using for data collection to try and capture these rich experiences and to find meaning across all of these different experiences?
Oh, yes. So I use both qualitative and quantitative methods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Canada has a very robust statistics collection process, or mm-hmm. data bank.
Mm-hmm.
So I rely a lot on a lot of data collected by ILCC.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them I try to use AI to model the data I collected to see the trends.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also going to do ethnographic research. In that sense, I'm going to meet these young people, try to get access into these communities, speak to them, observe them over a period of 6 months,
mm-hmm.
observe their stories, observe them from when they join some of these networks to when they are trained, to when they start looking for work, to when they actually get the work they're looking mm-hmm. for, and probably also a few months into their work to understand the kind of issues they face, to understand how that pivoting happened for those who pivoted from whatever career they had back home to whatever career that they're going to have or they are pivoting to in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So that sense of following my research subjects or participants, I believe, will give me some kind of in-depth knowledge
mm-hmm.
Into their lives and into some of the issues they face. And yes, and so, yeah, so as you know, with the growth in AI and the increase in its popularity and its popular use, mm-hmm. I felt concerned about my chosen discipline.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this kind of existential career crisis, I would say, which caused me to reach out to these mentorship networks.
Mm-hmm.
And for the next 6 months, I learned a tech skill and I wrote the exams, I got the certificates.
Mm-hmm.
So I see how those tech skills help me today
mm-hmm.
in my career, even as an academic, broaden my knowledge in so many ways mm-hmm. of tech systems. I mean, using technology for your research is also makes it more productive and generative, mm-hmm. I guess. So I have access to these networks and I have my own personal experience as well, which I will also be drawing on in my research.
No, it's helpful, right? Because you, when you are doing your mixed methods collection with both, like you mentioned, quantitative analysis and also qualitative analysis and kind of ethnographic work, you really truly understand some of the feelings or fears that drive people to look for these, for mentorship in these different networks. And just kind of anecdotally, I know I have had other folks in my personal life who've had to pivot as well from different career paths because they're quite worried about the path that they were on being heavily disrupted by emerging technologies. So I think it's something that many people are thinking about right now, both on a personal level and on a broad level, on a societal level. And I know you recently actually organized an event around the theme of your research, because as we've said, it's front of mind for many people. So can you tell us a little bit about what that event was and how it went?
Oh, yes. The event was titled BIT, short for Black Innovation and Tech Futures Forum. It was BIT 25, so Black Innovation and Tech Futures Forum 25. And the purpose of the event was to gather people on the table to have a conversation about the future of tech and how Black people in Canada are positioned around and in it. So the event got a lot of interest by a lot of people, individuals, and also a lot of groups. We got funding from the Postdoc Initiative Fund, which is some money that could be assessed by postdocs who want to do this kind of events or community outreaches. And we also were funded by the Canada Research Chair in Youth and African Urban Futures, Dr. Grace Adeniyi Oguyanki. And we also got in-kind sponsorship from NSB, which is National Society of Black Engineers, and also from Black Youth in STEM at Queen's, which is an organization that helps mentor young folk in STEM around Kingston. And, you know, different people as well. And the event spotlighted the works of a few Black people who are doing amazing work around tech, around community building, and around innovation as well. So we had Dr. Charles Onu, who is the founder and CEO of Ubenwa, the first app to analyze babies' cries, who came all the way from Toronto. And we also had Mr. Patrick Ebunonu, who is an AI veteran in Canada, who has been doing a lot of community-facing work around tech and AI and Black people as well, with Black people. And we had Ms. Krasena Williams-Massey, who is the team lead for the Black Youth in STEM program. And we also had Yvonne Anabaranze, who is a PhD student and an IBET fellow here at Queen's. We also had a short talk by the DDQIC in Queen's. They are an organization, would I say, body, and they work around innovation in Queen's, and they give small grants to young innovators who have ideas and are entrepreneurial and want to make the ideas come true, like move it from the initiation stage to the, you know, to the actual product. And they've been doing amazing work for so many years around Queen's, and they came around to give a talk or presentation on some of their events and some of their initiatives and how people could key into these initiatives and funding. And we had over 60 to 70 people attend.
Wow, that's really great attendance, especially,
Yes, which was great. And a funny story, there was a funny incident during the event. The fire alarm went off.
So
we had to leave the building. And for 20 minutes, we were outside in freezing cold. That was probably one of the coldest nights in Kingston so far. But people stayed, right? They wanted to stay until the end of the event because the conversations were on point and relevant, and they really wanted to get the best out of the event, so they stayed all the way until we could go back to the building. So this shows me that people are really interested in knowing how they can position themselves better and remain relevant in a very fast shifting economy. And the event was really focused on Black people. We spoke about the challenges that may occur in terms of based on identity. We spoke about how different people navigate the ecosystems and how different people, how you can get funding for your innovations, how, you know, how to basically position or situate yourself for progress in the tech ecosystem. So it was a wonderful event, and I hope to host more in the future in Queen's.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. No, because I, as someone, I support events, and to have 60 to 70 people show up in a post-COVID world in person, that is an incredible turnout. So congratulations on the hard work and the success you've had in organizing this event. And I think you're right. I think it shows the appetite for your research and for creating spaces for these types of conversations. And I think it's really interesting that you are studying mentorship networks and how people are succeeding and looking for ways to succeed, while you yourself are also creating these networks by hosting these types of events and mobilizing the same communities that you support with your research and supporting them through the ways that they identify, ways they identify new ways to train and build networks and ways that help them advance in whatever their career or professional goals might be. So you're both studying it, but also implementing the best practices. I mean, that's what I'm seeing from the outside. So it sounds like a really, really great initiative. And I hope we'll see more of these events throughout your time here at Queen's.
I really hope so. I have plans for next year and look out for it.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, we will definitely, you'll have to let the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs know, because we'd love to highlight and advertise those, because it's really exciting to see you bring together folks from across Kingston, really greater, the Southern Ontario and across Queens and out between Queens and across Queens, and folks who might come to Queens for the first time for such an event. So I think it's really exciting. So thank you for sharing that with us. And I guess this kind of segues into my next question, which is, what are some of your plans on research outputs and disseminations? And who do you think is going to benefit from this research?
Oh, yes. Fantastic question, because as you said, it draws on my previous response and the previous question you asked. So one of the ways I hope to disseminate this research is by doing events,
mm-hmm.
right? And I'm glad I started this year by doing this BIT 25 that I just spoke about. But I've always wanted to be unique in the sense that I value good writing, of course, and I value good academic writing, mm-hmm. and I've had quite a lot of success in publishing my work across very reputable and high standard journals. But I also want my work to be public facing.
Mm-hmm.
I want people who are non-experts to also be able to consume my work and understand it and feel it, mm-hmm. right? I want to make good use of public money, funders' money. I want my research to be, you know, to spill into the community, mm-hmm. more or less. So I will, of course, publish my work in journals. I hope to prepare it into a book for Oxford University Press.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, I also hope to produce a short documentary.
Oh, very cool.
Yes, on the same subject. Mm-hmm. And some of the documentary will also draw on some of the events I will host throughout the year, to show how Black people are coming together to have these conversations. And the documentary will also follow the lives of a few people who came to Canada with their hopes and dreams, and try to connect the hopes and dreams they had while they were back home, the preparations they made while they were back home, and their experiences generally,
mm-hmm.
to connect it to the realities on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll basically perhaps follow them. The documentary will take like a year or two to make, because mm-hmm. I'll have to follow them from when they're applying to move to Canada to when they actually get here and start training and when they get a job. And the documentary will probably be sent to festivals,
mm-hmm.
and will be made open access afterwards for people to watch and enjoy. And I also work around graphic novels.
Mm-hmm.
So some of my research, maybe not this one, but my future research will make use or utilize the graphic novel to, you know, take this research to younger audiences,
mm-hmm.
and to translate heavy academic data to more simplified, more digestible content. So that's my plan.
Oh, that sounds really exciting, because I know it is a challenge of research, right, is that you put so much effort into creating really high quality, verifiable, clear results and findings, but they're so by their nature, they're created for an academic audience. And sometimes that doesn't necessarily translate well to a non-academic audience. So I think it's really exciting that you are building in these different types of knowledge translation and knowledge mobilization right into your research plans, really putting that at the forefront and showing, I think, both the research community and the broader community that those different types of research outputs, whether it's academic publishing or a monograph with Oxford University Press, or if it's a documentary or a graphic novel aimed at youth, they carry equal weight, right? They carry importance, and they're things that need to be done together, not just in isolation, and then that one supports the other. So I really look forward to seeing your film when it comes out. Hopefully, I don't know how these things work, but it would be great to see it at the Kingston Film Fest if we could see that in the future, and hopefully some other film festivals as well. And, you know, maybe we can, I don't know, again, I don't know how these things work, so around around copyright and things, but it would be fun to screen a viewing or multiple viewings across campus to really bring the community back in at Queen's to get to see all the work that you're doing while you're here.
That's a great idea. I know. I'll ensure that, for sure.
Well, we'll see. As I said, I don't know how film rights work, but I'd love to see it more. And I know it sounds like you've got so much community work on the go for your own projects, but I hear that you're also involved in other initiatives that are related but not directly in your research. Can you tell us a little bit about the Ottawa Responsible AI Summit that you've been working on?
Oh, yes. I'm the chair of the Ottawa Responsible AI Summit, which happened 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
That was on the 19th of November. And it was practically bringing together different stakeholders in AI, policymakers, the designers, students, professors, and the general public to discuss the future of responsible AI in Ottawa, but also broadly in Canada. So Canada has an AI task force, which they constituted a few months ago to really consult different partners and stakeholders to understand, you know, how Canada can best implement AI and use AI around work, around community, around the public service. So we gathered these different partners, some of them from PwC, from Microsoft, from Google. Some of the experts came from Queens, from Europe, different parts of, from MILA as well, from the Canada Digital Service, to, you know, sit on a round table, I mean the metaphorical round table, to discuss the future of responsible AI. And I was invited to chair that summit because of my experience with organizing events and because of my research generally in technology and young people and new technologies, right? So the event went really well. We had funding from Microsoft, from Invest Ottawa, and from other sponsors as well. And then we also had over 200 people attend.
Wow, again, that is a huge, huge event.
Right. People attend. And we had the opening address by the MP of Kanata, who was the former Minister of Families, Children and Social Development. I hope I got that right. So it was and she brought in the state government perspective to talk about what the government is doing to achieve responsible AI in Canada. And I guess we all went home from the event, having some sort of confidence that there are people who are really concerned about the ethical implementation of AI in our country.
No, that's really exciting to know that there are folks in high-level policy positions who are concerned about the ethical use of AI in Canada now and hopefully into the future, because I know that's front of mind for many people. Well, it sounds like the Ottawa Responsible AI Summit as well as BIT 25 were really successful events for you this month, and I can't wait to hear more into the future about what events you'll be up to next. So Dr. Woke, it has been great chatting with you. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and really best of luck with the rest of your research projects.
Thank you so much for having me. Please invite me next time.
Yes, anytime. We'll have to hear about all the great things that are coming soon. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download this show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcast, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. Until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Music doesn't need a visa. 有些声音不用翻译也能听懂。No genre limits. Kokyomo Nai. I'm your host, Hai Tong Ni. Tune in Thursday morning in 10 a.m. on CFRC. This is From CN to CA.
Tu as 14 à 30 ans et tu veux créer une activité en français pour les jeunes de ta communauté? Avec le programme VIF, c'est possible. Tu peux recevoir 850$ pour ton soutenir ton activité et l'organisme partenaire reçoit 150$ pour appuyer. Passe à l'action et fais rayonner le français dans ta communauté. Visite programmevif.ca et dépose ta demande dès maintenant.